from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in the hour ahead, people often see negotiating as an adversarial process, says Stanford business professor Margaret Ann Neal. But that's wrong, she argues in her new book, Getting More of What You Want. Neal suggests that the best negotiators focus on problem solving and building relationships. And she'll join us in studio to offer strategies for negotiating in the workplace and at home, whether it's getting a raise, selling a company, or just figuring out who should put the kids to bed. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Whether it comes to seeking a raise, shopping for a car, or haggling over who should take out the trash, negotiations that focus on problem solving and building relationships often prove to be more successful than other kinds of negotiations, or at least so argues researcher and author Margaret Ann Neal in her most recent book, Getting More of What You Want. The Adams Distinguished Stanford Professor of Management and Stanford's Graduate Business School joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and we welcome her to the program. And it's going to be Maggie, right?
Right. That's Thanks, Michael.
Glad to have you here. Welcome to the program. I remember a book that came out many years ago, which I'm sure you're probably familiar with, by Herb Cohen, called You Can Negotiate Anything. Are you a believer in that? Can you negotiate anything?
I think that there are very few things that are not negotiable. Probably taxes, although that part of those are negotiable, but maybe death. I think that one's not negotiable.
Taxes and death would not be negotiable. I would have to agree with you. But negotiations, you say, are not or shouldn't be an adversarial process. And that's an important thing, I think, for people to recognize, because often they think of it in that frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's not that negotiations shouldn't be an adversarial process, because some situations they are. But we walk in with the expectation that they will be an adversarial process. And one of the most powerful predictors of what happens is often what we expect to happen. So if we expect a battle, we behave in a way that ensures we get a battle. And oftentimes when we are in a battle, winning that battle becomes more important than what it is we've won.
There are some people who are just almost, by any kind of reckoning, impossible to negotiate with. They come in, I'm talking about like people looking for a compensation raise, that sort of thing, and you hear about these bosses who are absolutely immovable, to use a word, and hostile too.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the challenge. When, say, I'm trying to negotiate a raise and I am currently employed and I'm going to you, my supervisor, my superior, to ask for a raise. I actually need to be a little more thoughtful than just walking in and saying, I'd like more money. And you can imagine your response would be, well, why? And I go, well, because more money is better than less. What's the reason behind that? And as I'm preparing for that conversation, a very critical question is, what is it about giving me a raise that works for you, my counterpart? Why is it in your interest to give me a raise? And I would also suggest that I need to broaden that conversation beyond just a raise, but rather think about the resources that I need in order to do my job better, which is actually a clue to why my counterpart might say yes.
Well, you actually have pointed out on a number of occasions the foolishness of not going for, say, a raise. I mean, of deciding not to negotiate. I'll get into some gender differences here because they play an important role, I know. But use this example of $7,000 raise in 8 years. I mean, maybe you can lay that out for listeners.
Well, yeah, one of the things that we do, oftentimes people will say, it's really, you know, doesn't seem worthwhile to negotiate if I get a lot of negative attributions, like I'm too greedy or I'm demanding, I'm not likable. And the kind of raise I might get, maybe it's really small. And one of the things that we do is that we really kind of push that out and try to really analyze what is the long-term implications of not negotiating. And so imagine, you know, for ease of multiplication and sort of math in your head, that you've been made an offer for $100,000 and a colleague of yours, exactly equivalent to you, except that person negotiates and you don't. They get a $7,000 raise, let's say. So they get 107. You started at 100. And let's say the company treats you and your counterpart identically. And so over the next, I don't know, let's say 30 years, you're at the company. They give you and your counterpart the same percent increase, right? 5%, for example. And the question is, by the time your counterpart decides to retire, how much longer will you have to work in order to be as wealthy as your counterpart is when that person retires?
And that comes down to 8 years.
It comes down to the equation
that you just offered us.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, again, when you get back to the fact that you don't necessarily have to see this as a fight, you should go into a negotiation. What's to lose, really, when too many people decide, well, as you suggest, it's not worth the stake and I'm going to embarrass myself and I'm going to look like a fool and the boss will even hate me more and all those sort of things. But when you go in, a lot of this has to do with attitude, doesn't it? I mean, when you go in with say you're not looking for a fight, but you're looking for some kind of creative solution, it makes a great deal of difference in what you're going to reap.
Well, I think it makes a great deal of difference in how you approach the situation, and it changes your expectation. And as we interact, my expectations affect how you think about this situation. So if I'm seeing this as something that I really hate to do and I'm already armored up, you know, I'm ready for that fight, you're going to see that. And your response naturally is going to be to respond in kind. You're going to armor up. And then we've got a fight.
So this should become collaborative, problem solving, that kind of thing,
yeah.
Right? And not only when you're going for a raise, but maybe everyday actions, marriages, et cetera.
Well, that's... You know, one of the arguments that my co-author and I make in the book is that if you sort of take this problem-solving perspective, then so many more things open up to negotiation because you don't have to worry about picking a fight with your counterpart.
Talking to Maggie Neal, and she is Adams Distinguished Professor of Management in the Stanford University Graduate School of Business, also co-author of the book, Getting More of What You Want. Why are women more hesitant to negotiate? What is it in general that you found in your research that makes them more hesitant?
Well, it turns out that there is not a level playing field. Let's say we have a set of words we're going to use to ask for a raise. And I happen to be male and I use those words, or I happen to be female and I use those words. So the exact same words, the exact same person, except we just switch the gender. It turns out that the woman in this situation will be perceived as greedy, demanding, and not nice.
And the B word in many instances. Yeah.
Possibly. Yeah. But what happens is there's no equivalent negative attribution to the male for making the request for a raise. And so we women have figured that out. We get this backlash. And so we are more hesitant to initiate a negotiation because the costs are greater. Add to that that on average, women have lower expectations about what they're going to get in those kinds of situations. So you have low expectations, you get a bigger pushback.
It's not, two strikes.
It's not unreasonable to say, you know what, I think I won't negotiate.
Fact is, women are judged differently. I mean, that's the bottom
yes.
line here. And as you say, go in with lower expectations. What else do women need to know, though, about negotiating that can help them perhaps overcome some of this?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. I think that it is, number one, the importance of not viewing negotiation as a battle, because one of the big hurdles that women face is we don't want to get caught in that battle. Focusing on negotiation as a collaborative problem-solving perspective, and I want to be real clear here. When I talk about that, the first thing I want to identify is that when I talk about collaborative problem-solving, I am looking as the protagonist, looking for a solution that makes me better off than my status quo, better off than my alternative, better off than had I not negotiated. Now, your listeners might think, well, that's pretty low standard. You know, why would you do something that made you worse off? And yet all of us have, more times than we'd probably like to admit, voluntarily agreed to an outcome in a negotiation that made us worse off, right? So that's the first point. So I want to find a solution that makes me better off. And then secondly, I need to be able to frame that solution as an answer to the problems that my counterpart faces. And once I do that, you see, the concern a lot of women have is they'll be perceived as greedy or demanding. But it's a lot harder to view me as greedy or demanding when I'm helping you, my counterpart, solve your problem.
It's going to be a lot better for you if you give me a raise.
Well, you have to be a little more creative
little,
than that.
A little more nuanced and subtle.
Right.
Yeah. But you use the word communal. Let's explore that a little bit. Framing things in a communal way and communal package and so forth. What do you
mean? Well, one of the challenges and one of the ways that women can sort of mitigate this unequal playing field is that they need to pair their negotiation, their ask, with a communal concern for the other. What does that mean? That means that you're basically saying, why is it that my request will help you out, help the organization out? So one of the challenges that we all face is when we're sort of thinking about negotiating, the question is, if I were to get what I wanted, what I'm asking for, what benefit does my counterpart get from that agreement? And unless my counterpart is kept whole or made better off, there's no reason for him or her to say yes to me. So I've got to be able to understand their needs, their interests, their preferences, and be able to shape my proposal, my request, as a solution to problems that they experience.
But often you have a real chasm, a gulf between power of the person, mm-hmm. for example, who's in the boss's chair, that sort of thing, and the person who's coming in with a tin cup, really, asking for some kind of promotion or advance in salary. I mean, when we talk about negotiations, normally we talk about leverage and the power dynamic and so forth. But you're speaking about maybe a more esprit de corps or something along those lines?
Well, the first thing is I wouldn't characterize myself, even if I'm in a low power position, as coming in with the tin cup. Because the reason that you're even willing—
I'm just trying to be facetious, but often that is the case.
But even if you're willing to be, if you're willing to engage me in a negotiation, you've hired me, I'm part of your organization, there are resources that I bring to that table that are useful for you, otherwise I wouldn't be there. But what's really interesting is research that we've done has found that if you're thinking about value creation— the engine of value creation is that person who is in a lower power position. High power players do not think about how to create value mostly. What they think about is how much of the value that is created will I claim? What do I get out of this? The low power player, knowing they're facing a higher power player, realizes that we've got to kind of feed the beast and still have enough to live. So the creativity comes from the low power player.
Talking again with Maggie Neal in her book she co-authored is called Getting More of What You Want. How do you get more of what you want in everyday situations? Let's take, for example, the fact that roommates, people who are living together, married couples and so forth, there's a real division of labor. And there's often, frankly, negotiations that have to go on in division of labor. Often there's, again, a power dynamic that can be different to one side or the other, depending on maybe who's more forceful, who's more aggressive, who has more cards to hold or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, how do you get more of what you want just in that kind of domestic situation?
Well, in the domestic situation, this notion of problem solving is exactly the right way to go. I mean, one of the things that most people don't know about me is that before I became an academic, I used to be a therapist and I did marriage and family counseling. And if you characterize your negotiations with your spouse or your partner as I've got more power, I've got more money, you're going to have to do what I want to do, I'm going to win this battle, the likelihood of that relationship lasting is pretty low. Part of what successful relationships require is that folks engage in a problem-solving perspective to create the value that potentially exists between the two of them. And whether those are discussions around how do we rear the children, who's going to do the dishes versus who's going to do the cooking, those sorts of things are all about, you know, can we find a way that make both parties feel as if this solution allows the relationship to progress rather than having a winner and a loser.
Too often you hit an impasse. You hit a brick wall, right? I mean, you know that as a therapist as well as a negotiation expert. Yeah.
If you have this negative, this sort of view is, I'm going to win, right?
Yeah. Even sometimes, both may have that same negative view, I'm going to win, and so they come into an impasse, right?
Right? Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you break through those kinds of things, I guess. I'm thinking about, and especially when you're in like a team situation and the team has to work with common purpose. I mean, you've written about mm-hmm. this, and I think it's a very important elemental kind of thing. But how do you foster that, particularly when you've got kind of obstinate people who believe they're both right and don't give any ground?
Well, if we were talking about how to do that within the context of a team— The first thing that I would suggest, and actually this is a suggestion that I often use with my negotiation students, is the first thing you need to think about is let's have a discussion about what the goals are. What are our values? Certainly in a marriage or in a partnership, right, those conversations about the important values and goals of the interaction are critical. One of the things that becomes useful then, once you've sort of identified the goals and mission and the values that you hold, they become wonderful touchstones to be able to say, you know, we have this conversation. You're thinking you're really right. I'm thinking I'm really right. Let's look back to these common goals and values that we hold and the mission that we're trying to achieve and how do these things move that forward. So you use that as a way to sort of think about, you know, how can we fashion a solution, right, that is consistent with this, given our strong beliefs.
So a lot of this has to do with, again, seeing what's best for both involved. I mean, when you really mm-hmm. come down to it, and making sure that you figure out with your negotiating partner not only what's best for you, but what's best for your negotiating partner, what he or she might accept. But you have to have a kind of a bottom line here, don't you, where you're going to put things at risk?
Absolutely. One of the challenges that most of us face is that once we get into a negotiation, we don't have a clearly delineated line where we say no. Because for many of us, we have a very simple view of negotiations. First, it's a battle. But then what we really look for is agreement equals success. And if we walk away from a negotiation and we don't have an agreement, then by that definition, we have failed.
So you have to be ready to walk away, don't you?
One of the biggest sources of influence in a negotiation is your ability to walk away, to be able to say no.
Most people don't go in with that attitude. They're probably in some ways a lot more sanguine than they ought to be.
Well, I think that what's important is to understand that, you know, even as I try to solve a problem with you, my counterpart, right, that there may be a situation, and maybe this is one of those referring back to the situation earlier that you mentioned where you're such at loggerheads, that there is no solution. Not every interaction, not every negotiation has to come to a mutually acceptable agreement, right? Sometimes we just say, you know what, no harm, no foul, but no.
You also talk about baby steps. I mean, this is a concept in terms of negotiation maybe a lot of people don't bring to the table.
So one of the things that I think is important is first to understand what your parameters are. So what you know is your bottom line, and what you know is your alternative. What happens to you if you don't get a deal? Because those can really have an impact. Because oftentimes what happens is you get so caught up in negotiations that you forget about what your alternatives are, and you take a deal worth less than your alternatives. But the notion of baby steps is that sometimes you just need to practice. You need to get into situations and say, wow, let's negotiate.
Not necessarily 10,000 hours of practice like Malcolm Gladwell suggested.
Well, most of us have actually had more practice than that. The problem with practice is you need to have an understanding of what perfect is. Practice makes perfect. You need to know that what that goal is. So 10,000 hours of really bad negotiating won't make you an expert.
There's another notion that you bring to the fore, and that is it's kind of a four-step process, and let's see mm-hmm. if we can outline this because it may be really useful for people in interactions of all kinds or going mm-hmm. for a raise or whatever. Assess, prepare, act, package.
Mm-hmm.
You break this down?
Sure. The first is to assess. And part of what I'm talking about when we focus on assessing is I need to understand what it is I'm trying to achieve in this interaction. So clearly, I need to know what my alternatives are. What happens to me if no agreement were reached? Then the second component of that assessment is, as it relates to me, is, well, what's my bottom line? What's that point where, you know, I'm right there at that indifference point, that tipping point between yes and no? And then what I need to understand is, what would be a really good deal? Because one of the things that happens is, for most of us, we tend to focus on what happens if we don't get a deal, and what that means is that our aspirations and our expectations are low. And one of the challenges that we know from, you know, decades of research is that expectations drive behavior. So if you have low expectations, that's where you'll end up. So I've got to have an aspiration. What is an optimistic assessment of what I could achieve in this negotiation? Now, as we assess, that's me. I'm talking about me and what my alternatives, reservation price, and aspiration are. But I've also got to understand you. So I'm going to be focusing on understanding what your concerns are, what your interests are, what you want to achieve, what is a good deal for you. And once I have all of that, then the question is, should I go forward? Is this an opportunity for negotiation? And once I've made that assessment, then I have to do the ask, right? I have to actually get into the situation and perhaps make a proposal and explain how that proposal, that solution, is a solution to my counterpart's problem.
If you've just joined us, our guest is Maggie Neal. She's Adams Distinguished Professor of Management in the Stanford University Graduate School of Business, co-author of Getting More of What You Want. There's a guy who had a book written, ghosted now, it turns out, called The Art of the Deal. You mentioned the deal. I'm talking, of course, about Donald Trump. And if you haven't seen the article in The New Yorker, it's really quite illuminating. Essentially, Tony Schwartz, who did the book, really, who mm-hmm. authored the book, who was written as co-author, comes out and talks about how he saw working with Trump and so forth. But Trump has become identified as a great negotiator, as one of the great deal makers of all time. I mean, if anything, it's vaunted him into the public eye and made him a really extraordinarily powerful political figure now, the presumptive Republican nominee. From what you've observed, therapist as well as researcher in negotiation, what kind of negotiator is Donald Trump?
Donald Trump is not a negotiator that focuses on problem solving. Donald Trump focuses on, in his negotiation, and the way he talks about it in the book, is also focused on what do I get? Me? Well, how much value can I claim? And so the notion of value creation is pretty much absent in his lexicon. And what's interesting is what that means is that he only succeeds in negotiating with people who actually really need. They don't have good alternatives. When people have good alternatives, they're not going to be involved in a negotiation with that kind of situation because, you know what, I've got a better deal outside. And one of the things that's interesting is if you read that book, it seems like the only strategy that really plays out through it is what's called fake it till you make it. So you create the situation that looks like you're all very powerful and all-knowing and sort of, you know, the Wizard of Oz, and you hope the other people fall for your story.
Smoke and mirrors. Mm-hmm. And BS and salesmanship, I guess, too, you know, to a degree. Yeah, yeah. Okay. And bullying, really. I mean, this is not a smart negotiation tactic, and yet people would say, well, Trump is a bully, but he's been successful.
Well, as long as you have an unlimited resources for lawyers, I mean, even if you're wrong, you can run the other
side. He's suing
side.
Tony Schwartz, by
yes.
the way.
Yes. He's also – but that's another strategy that seems to be very common. But as you have enough resources to be able to tie people up into litigation until – because they're weaker than you, they're less wealthy, then you tie them up until they have to give in.
And there's something on YouTube about an architect who had this experience
right.
with Trump, exact experience you just described. Well, I know many of you have questions about negotiation and maybe problems and ways to perhaps look for solutions. Talking about negotiation generally, but also negotiations in gender and now Donald Trump, we invite you to join the program. You may want to, in fact, pose a problem to Maggie Neal that you need as far as negotiation, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. That number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Stanford's Margaret Ann Neal, better known as Maggie Neal, is our guest this hour. She's the author, co-author of Getting What You Want in the Workplace and at Home, and Getting More of What You Want, actually co-author of that, author of Getting What You Want in the Workplace and at Home. And some of you may have some questions or maybe are looking for solutions, as I said earlier, vis-a-vis negotiations and how they can the art of negotiation or the craft of negotiation can be of best advantage applied by you personally. We do welcome your involvement in the program. You may want to talk with us about some of the things we touched on here, including gender and the role it plays in negotiation, not necessarily to the advantage of women. We even started talking at the end of the first segment about Donald Trump as a negotiator. And please feel free to join the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum, and You know, you're a shoeaholic, right? Sometimes you write books, you reveal more of yourself than you think you will, right? But you negotiated, even when you buy a pair of shoes sometimes, yeah?
Well, usually I'm buying more than one, but yes.
There's a story there, isn't there?
So there is. One of the challenges that people face is that we oftentimes have a very clear definition of what is and what is not negotiable. And so one of the things that I do that basically surprises a lot of my students, whether those are MBA students, undergraduates, or executives, is that I actually negotiate in upscale department stores. And one of the things that I spend a lot of time searching for is the perfect shoe. Now, one of the challenges I have is that I have actually very large feet.
So this is a Cinderella story.
It's pretty much, except Cinderella, I think, which is minor. But the challenge here is that, you know, there's a limited number of shoe stores that carry these large shoes. And so what I often do is find myself in situations where I need to go in during the sales and try to get the coolest, most wonderful shoes. And there's a lot of people who might want those shoes as well. So it's like I'm trying to negotiate when but the seller and I both know that these shoes will be sold. There's no – it's not like there's something wrong with them or whatever. And so one of the things that I challenge my students to do is to go into situations like that. Go to a department store. Find something that you like, as I like shoes, and attempt to negotiate the price. And – while I encourage them to do that, one of the things that I am very clear about is that they will not always be successful. But I will
– a lot of those retail prices are just fixed. I mean, they're in stone, right?
They're not in stone. That's the whole point. Certainly the sellers want you to believe they're in stone because they're the ones who set the price. And it's rare that when you're about to purchase something, a seller will say to you, stop, you're paying too much. Let's negotiate. So if there's going to be a negotiation, it's going to be at the behest of the buyer. And so even if you fail, that store is probably not going to take your picture, post it on the door and say that person can't come in anymore because they behave badly.
But then you're going to buy like a number of pairs of shoes.
What I typically do is I buy a couple of pairs of shoes. Some of them are very boring black pumps because I teach. I stand up for 3 to 4 to 5 hours a day. So they have to be, you know, sort of workmanlike shoes. And then every once in a while, there's that pair of shoes that just they make you sing when you look at them. And there's no way you can wear them for 3 to 4 hours. These are shoes that you wear. And a lot of the women in the audience will understand this, that it doesn't matter how much they hurt. Like, we're not walking anywhere. I'm taking a cab, right? But you look down at them, and they just make you feel good. And those are the shoes that are oftentimes very expensive and very poorly discounted in the sales.
And so you went in once and found a pair of those shoes. It was discounted. I think I have the story right.
Yes.
And you said, I'm going to buy 4 pairs of these or something.
No, what I said was, I'm going to buy these 3 boring pairs of black pumps.
Yeah.
And I really, really like these shoes, but they're too expensive. Can you help me? And so the shoe person, the salesperson there, said, absolutely, ma'am. Here's what you do. You buy these shoes now at this price. Don't wear them. And then go out. Come back in a week because after the first week, we discount the sale shoes that are left by 50%. Come back, return the shoes, and then we'll have you – you can return them. We'll mark them down 50%, and then you can pick them up again. And I said, well, you know, I actually live an hour from this store each way. I'm not doing that. Can you help me? Is there something else you can do? And he said, well, let me talk to my manager. So he goes into that secret room where they keep the shoes that they won't let us go into. And he was gone for, I don't know, 5-6 minutes. And he comes back out and he says, we'll take another $75 off these shoes. And I said, thank you. How hard is that?
The art of the deal, the real art of the deal. Let me read some questions that are coming in here and then we'll go to your calls. Anna asks, any tips for keeping emotional overreaction in check when negotiating?
Yes, preparation. Part of the reason that people become emotional in negotiation is because they're getting frustrated. They're hitting a barrier. And they oftentimes hit that barrier because they haven't done their homework to figure out how to characterize that solution as a solution to their counterpart's problems. But even if And this, I think, is really important. Even if your situation is you hit that barrier and it's a firm no, let's say from your employer. You know, you ask for a raise, you've done all your homework, you've done a really good job, but they say no. Rather than kind of just kind of being dejected, putting your tail between your legs and walking out, my suggestion to you is that you stop, you turn and say, okay, at this point, you don't think that I am qualified by work product, by accomplishments for this raise, for this position. What do I need to do? Where am I now? What do I need to do? Because remember that this is an ongoing negotiation. And so you're doing a couple of things by engaging your counterpart in that conversation. One is you're saying, you know, I understand and I want to work towards that. I want to make me a better contributor to this organization. Tell me what I need to do.
That's a good tack. I mean, as opposed to what some people do is get angry and say, you're telling me I'm not worth what I'm asking you for.
Right.
And therefore, you're making me – so suddenly the emotion comes out. Yeah.
And secondly, you're also alerting them that you will be back when you have met those goals. So be prepared. This is an ongoing interaction.
One more question before we go to our callers. Jeff says, your guest speaks of negotiating for better pay, but what many of us want is more time off. Unfortunately, almost all companies flat out refuse to offer more vacation time in exchange for pay. Human resources wants everybody on the same plan, and often what they hear is company policy when they ask for time off. Suggestions?
Sure. Here's what I'd suggest. First is that we, you know, a lot of people ask questions about how do I get a better, how do I get more money? And, you know, as Jeff suggests, I'm going to actually broaden that conversation, because if I'm going to be negotiating about a potential improvement in my compensation, and I'm broadly defining compensation, that's a number of different issues. And I think the most successful negotiations are those that are engaged in a negotiation at the package level. So there are multiple issues we're negotiating over, not just salary, but salary. Maybe it's time off, or maybe it's control of your schedule. That time off might be more working virtually rather than being in the office. Maybe having a different set of
hours.
You've
got options, yeah.
You have options, and you have lots of different things. Maybe I need a better and in order to help that work schedule, I need better technology, or I need more marketing support. All those things that would help you do your job better.
What about the person who just wants more time off? I'm satisfied with my salary. I'm okay with it.
Well, I think that the issue there is, why would more time off – again, go back to the first part we discussed. Why would more time off – why would my counterpart say yes to that?
Makes me more productive. I can spend more time with my family. I can be happier. You know, all those kinds of things.
But why does your counterpart care about that?
Because I'm a better employee. I'm going to be
okay.
A better
and how
employee.
Am I going to be a better employee? That's the focus that you take. And the notion that it's so. Let's go back to the other part of the question, which was it's precedent. We all have the same. The reality is that there's very few absolute precedents in organizations. For example, I oftentimes hear from my students, they say, well, this is what this consulting firm offers to people. It's one, you know, it's basically one offer for people getting their MBAs. And my response is, well, that by definition has to be the average. If you're the average MBA or you're below average, say yes to that deal. But if you're above average for some reason, like maybe you have spent more time in consulting than the average MBA, you know, asking for a job there, maybe you have some expertise that is unique. You are not in that precedent. So identify the way in which your skills, abilities, knowledge separate you out from that precedent.
Maggie Neal is our guest. Let's get our callers on here. We begin with you, Brett from Mill Valley. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Maggie, I just wanted to – I'm an attorney in the Mill Valley, and, you know, it's amazing to me how many people are just – kind of like take the Trump approach with negotiations as an attorney. One of my questions actually was already answered by the email, but I had another question for you. When you're dealing with somebody, you're trying to work with them to make something work out in a negotiation, and they're just, you know, acting as if they're Trump or somebody in that sense, where they're trying to do hardball negotiate, always trying to get, you know, they're 100% as opposed to actual negotiation. How do you deal with somebody like that?
Maggie Neal.
There are a couple of things you can do. The first thing I would recommend that you absolutely know what your bottom line is, so you know when the point is you're going to say, you know what, we don't have a deal here and we're not going to have a deal at this level. But the other thing that I think is actually more along the lines of the problem-solving perspective is with folks who are like that, where winning is the most important thing, less so what they've won, then I am going to behave in ways that will actually convince my counterpart that they have won because they have probably have a very narrow view of what issues are worth. They don't understand the nature of trade-offs. They just want to win. And so there are many situations where I can craft a solution that will give them the subjective experience of having won. And I'm quite happy to let them feel like they've beaten me if, in fact, I walk away with more.
So Brett, good luck to you, and thank you for the call. I get as many people as we can on here with Maggie Neal. Let me get to Adrian next. Adrian, you're on.
I am. Hi, this is Adrian, and you had spoken about the nuances when it's a woman coming to the table versus a man and the words that we use to describe her. I was wondering, is there the same sort of situation when the person that you're going to the table to negotiate with a man or a woman?
You know, it would be great. I think it would be, we oftentimes think that it's actually men who do this to women, but
it's often women.
The reality is that we have all been socialized in the same environment. And so whether your superior is male or female, according to the research, What happens is that they penalize women for being too demanding and not nice. Interestingly, I mean, if you're looking for a level playing field, if your superior is female, she often penalizes both males and females for their attempts to negotiate. So at least the playing field's level. It's not good, but it's level.
And I thank you for that call, and we'll get right to another call in a moment. But here's Larry who says, may I suggest that in these negotiations, it's crucial to understand the other person's role, real or perceived? In the raise example, you may be negotiating with someone who has only limited influence on the salary administration process and who cannot, no matter how compelling your position, take an independent action to give you what you want. Use the example, for example, going to the dean and then going to the provost. I mean, sometimes you really have to go up the ladder, don't you?
Sometimes you do, but what's interesting is it may be more effective if you can bring your boss in as an ally. It may be more effective to have him or her negotiate for you with that person who is the decision maker rather than for you going around them. So there's, you know, you need to think about how to be more effective in that kind of situation, and maybe it is initiate a negotiation with your boss, convince them, and let them take the negotiation further.
Rasha asks, do you have any advice for people thrown into blind negotiation?
Blind negotiations means without any preparation?
I presume.
Yeah. Here's the first suggestion. Take a break. Try to have some time. The problem with blind negotiation is that you're acting as if negotiation is some kind of improvisational theater where you can just kind of go with the flow and figure it out. This is a very dangerous position to be in because the strategies and tactics that your counterpart, who's just put you in that situation, is going to employ, you really have very little resistance to the effect of those strategies. So one suggestion, which is one I make all the time, is that when you're in situations where there might be even the faintest glimmer of the possibility of a negotiation, you need to know what a good deal is. And you need to think about the strategies and tactics that you would engage should the other side start the interaction as a negotiation. I've had numerous students who have failed to do this. They go into what they think is an initial interview, and their potential employer says, well, what would it take to get you here? And they are completely flat-footed. They have no answer.
Our guest is Maggie Neal, and she is Adams Distinguished Professor of Management in the Stanford University Graduate School of Business, also co-author of Getting More of What You Want. Let's get more of our callers on her and find out what they want or what they have to say. And we go next to Jerry. Jerry, you're on.
Hi. Hello, Michael, Maggie. This is such a great topic. So at this time, we're sitting here with a Democratic policymaking situation. What I'm hearing is more and more reactionary activity, and I'm just wondering if you have some advice on how we can find a way through this and to negotiate for what's wanted and what's needed in our country without walking away from each other. And thank you. I'll take my take your answers off.
Thank you for the call, Maggie Neal.
I think that one of the things that we need to do as voters is realize that a unrelenting commitment to ideology is a position that allows no negotiation. If we elect individuals and give them the mandate of finding solutions to the problems rather than saying you will only reelect you if you unrelentingly support an ideological position, then we're going to get people who are willing to problem solve. But as long as we say, if you try to problem solve, we're going to throw you out of office, they will not problem solve. So at the end of the day, this is us who are creating this monster.
Well, someone who's identified himself or herself as a 20-year-old retail veteran gives some pushback on your retail anecdote, writes, Neil's advice on bargaining with retail personnel is terrible and not in the best interest of the sales associate. Many companies will terminate employees for discounting product beyond corporately designated prices. This approach may work in mom-and-pop boutiques, but salespeople in corporately owned franchises would be leveraged into making decisions that put their job security at risk, even at the manager level.
Well, I think that that's not completely true. The mom and pop stores are actually probably more resistant to negotiating, and the big stores, the big box stores, probably more likely to negotiate. And many of their sales associates have clear strategies for responding to requests. And those strategies include matching. Those strategies include offering things. It's surprising, but they have to be asked. And by the way, asking is not demanding. And so the question is, if this puts a person at risk for their...
They can always say no.
They can always say no.
Yeah. And we'll bring another caller aboard here. Tom, you're on. Morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make a comment. After traveling in the Middle East and Asia many years ago, I've learned that many of the skills that your speaker has mentioned have already been perfected in the stoops and in the marketplace, including walking away from a situation, knowing where you stand. And it seems like they figured this out quite a few years ago. I take my answer on the radio.
Okay. I think he's talking about haggling in the bazaar and the marketplace and so forth.
Certainly. And I think that that's certainly one type of negotiation. The kinds of negotiation, and certainly the notion of I will not even pretend to be the person who identified, aha, you need to know where to walk away. That's been something that's been well known for decades. The problem is most of us don't have the discipline either, A, to identify what that point is or to implement that when it comes to that, until we get to that point where we have to walk away or say yes. But I agree. There's lots of different strategies that different cultures use and that are more or less effective. What's really interesting is, and this is something that I think I find my students actually self-report, we have a lot of international students coming to the U.S., and a lot of them come from cultures that, like in the Middle East and in East Asia, and they'll say, we negotiate all the time here in our home countries, but we wouldn't do it here because it's not done, period.
Cultural. And here's Jason who tweets, during my first review at my job, my boss told me she wanted to but couldn't give me more money. I asked for more time off instead and got it. And here's Jamie who asks, do you have any suggestions for negotiating for better pay when your counterpart says that an increase in pay is not in the budget?
Again, I would strongly encourage you to move away from a single issue negotiation like pay. Part of what most of us are in. Most of us are in a situation where we have a long horizon. And so the question is, maybe there's no money in the budget for a pay increase, but are there resources that I could get control of that would help me do my job better and put me in a better position for the next raise, for the next promotion? And I think that's what's the important perspective. For most of us, this is not the last job that we are negotiating. It is one in an ongoing stream, and we need to think about that future preparation.
This may be an impossible question to answer, but Prius asks, what do you do when the person doesn't join you at the table to negotiate?
The issue there is, why aren't they joining you at the table? And that's part of your planning and preparation. Why won't they come to the table? Maybe they don't come to the table because they are uncomfortable with negotiating. So here's the first question. Why are you characterizing this interaction as a negotiation? Is there a solution, a problem? Can we focus on that? One of the things that I think for me has always been very useful is to the extent that I can move away from situations that are characterized by my counterpart as negotiations. Because when they characterize a situation as negotiation, they're ready for a fight. And you can sort of imagine it's tough for me because I do research in negotiation, I teach courses in negotiation, I consult in negotiation, and I write books on negotiation. Most of my colleagues think when I open my mouth, I'm negotiating. So it's a challenge to be able to try to find a way to get people to think about, this is not a negotiation. We're about solving a problem that affects both of us.
And we go to more of your calls. Again, we're talking to Maggie Neal and her new book, Getting More of What You Want. And our next caller is Shenda. Good morning, Shenda. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for your time. This is a question for my friend who's having a problem at home. She needs to learn to negotiate out of this, I would think, so that's why I'm calling. She has a young baby at home, under 1 year old, and she is not able to bond with her kid or make decisions for her own child because her husband is completely entailing that to his parents and bringing them into the picture because they are helping take care of the baby. So what are some of your tips for her to get her life back? Basically, you know, trying to make decisions like what to feed the baby, you know, how to take him for a walk and just have fun with the baby the way mother should have.
Well, I think part of the problem here is that there's a real disparity in power between your friend and her in-laws and her husband. So in this situation, I think possibly a solution is not to simply say, this is what I want and I'm the mother, so it's going to happen, because that obviously hasn't worked. What she may need to do is think about how can she engage her in-laws in helping her become a better mother and being able to ask questions and direct the conversation and perhaps provide some opportunities to experiment with different approaches and maybe have some support from, you know, resources that are available to her, whether those be from sort of specialists in pediatrics or whatever, who say this might be a good strategy to try.
But you know, I'm thinking about, we had Leslie Stahl on, the ABC analyst commentator, 60 Minutes. She's written a book on being a grandmother, and she said there are many situations where the in-laws will come in, or the parents, for that matter, of the woman who's given birth, or one member of the couple who's given birth, and try to take over, and also say, you know, you're not doing this right. You have to do it this way and that way. And she says they have to be banished from the house in many instances. They can't even allow them to come in because they're so Budinsky, is a word we used to use, so interfering with the role of the mother and father.
Yeah, but in this case, it sounded like the father was in the league. So,
she needs another ally, maybe.
Right.
Thank you for the call. This is actually apropos of that last call. This is a listener who writes, this guest has an interesting perspective, and I find that many of the problems she speaks of regarding women in negotiations hold true for minorities, both male and female.
I think the answer to that is I agree with the writer on that. And I think one of the challenges that we face is that, you know, it's okay for some people to negotiate and it's not okay for others. And it's not even something that we're conscious of. This is what the surprising thing is, but it's so built into how we've been socialized that I think it becomes important for us to be able to, you know, it would be great. You know, my view is I'd love to have a world where this wasn't true. Absent that, and I'm pretty advanced in age, so I'm concerned that I won't be around if that world were ever to come to fruition. I want to find solutions that can mitigate those problems now. And I think that this notion of focusing on problem solving rather than battle is critical to being successful in negotiation, whether you are a man, a woman, a person of color, right? Get out of that battle mentality. knowing that on occasion you might have to be into that mentality. Sometimes their negotiations are just there's no other way. But don't take that as your first hypothesis. That's your last hypothesis.
Talk about first hypotheses. What about the cliches you often hear as first hypotheses? Honesty is the best policy. Never let them see you sweat. Those kinds of things.
Well, what's interesting is we do a lot of research on negotiation, and a lot of things that people think are true are not true. And one of the challenges that we face is trying to push back against a lot of those. Now,
are those two examples?
Are two examples. And let me be real clear about the honesty is the best policy. One of the challenges, I am not a proponent of lying, so don't take that from my next couple of statements. But one of the challenges is that you need to think about how will my counterpart interpret this behavior. And so, for examples, it's common that folks will ask, what's your bottom line? You know, what's your best and final offer? Or some variant of that question in a negotiation. And it's also equally common that whatever answer you give, they will not believe you. So the issue is what happens is what we do instead is rather than telling people what our true bottom line is, what we do is we give them our faux bottom line. And what happens? Well, that's fine if we both know it's faux, it's false. But what happens if I happen to be a truth teller? I'm one of those people who believes that honesty is the best policy. You ask me what your bottom line is, I tell you the truth, and then it increases the likelihood that we will have impasse, and it is you to whom truth has been told who will walk away.
All right, we'll leave it there. Maggie Neal, thank you for being with us. Appreciate your spending this hour with us. Again, Maggie Neal is Adams Distinguished Professor of Management in the Stanford Graduate School of Business and co-author of Getting More of What You Want. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online. We encourage that, kqed.org/forum. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.